Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, one of the most popular courses at the University of California, Berkeley, lately is called Physics for Future Presidents. You might wish that John McCain and Barack Obama were in the front row as they think about climate change and nuclear terrorism, that George Bush had taken the class before he lauded the hydrogen economy. Richard Muller teaches it this hour on Point. He's with us with the short course, What Future Presidents and You Need to Know About the Science of All We're Up Against. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Richard Muller. He's author of Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines, and a physics professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also the former winner of the A. MacArthur Fellowship and the National Foundation's Alan T. Waterman Award for Original Research. His course, Physics for Future Presidents, has been voted best class at Berkeley by his students. Richard Muller, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here.
So you look out at the presidential candidates in this race, and I'm guessing in earlier races as well, and shake your head a little bit at their level of, physics awareness?
Well, it's science awareness in general, and it's not just the presidents. Our government, many of the people in the government seem to show pride in their lack of technical knowledge. But we live in a high-tech era. And almost every policy decision has a high-tech component. I emphasize physics because I regard physics as the liberal arts of high technology. My students, after a semester of physics, feel that they should never be intimidated again by some new development. I think physics can be understood at that level. The math, the detailed computations are not the important things for the student or the future president to learn. What's really important is to have a grasp for what's important, how big are certain issues, how the numbers work out, to have the ability to have some vision as to where technology is going. That's what's really important.
We're going to look at the basics here, at what a future president needs to know fundamentally on climate change, energy, nukes, nuclear terrorism, and more in this hour. But Professor Muller, I wish you'd listen with us for just a second to a couple of presidents picking up the torch and attempting to light the way ahead for this country, and give us a little compare and contrast lesson here on how you see this as someone who teaches physics. We'll listen first to JFK and then to George W. Bush. Here's John F. Kennedy in a special address to Congress on May 25th, 1961, as he sets the country's sights on going to the moon.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space.
JFK set the goal, the country did it. Here, in 2003, in a State of the Union address, President George W. Bush spoke of a major push to move the country toward hydrogen power, an initiative that has not gone too far. Here he announces funding.
Tonight I'm proposing $1.2 billion in research funding so that America can lead the world in developing clean, hydrogen-powered automobiles.
Richard Muller joins us from the University of California at Berkeley. His class, Physics for Future Presidents, is one of the most popular on the campus, sometimes 1,000 students there. Professor Muller, compare these two clarion calls, then, if you would, when it comes to presidents and science and challenges and how they did.
Well, in 1961, there were scientists working at the highest levels of government. The president's, the head of the what was then called what's now called the Department of Energy, then was the Atomic Energy Commission, was physics professor Glenn Seaborg. And he and President Kennedy talked frequently. There was a very high-level group of people called the President's Science Advisory Committee, and they looked at these issues. The result was, for the Apollo program, they had really thought that through before President Kennedy made the announcement. There were no real breakthroughs that were necessary. The engineering was difficult, but they knew how to do it. And so a 10-year program costing, in current dollars, it cost $135 billion. Mm. And that was a realistic program, pushing the edge, requiring a big commitment from the population, $135 billion over, even over 13 years, which is how it was spent, mm-hmm. Is still $10 billion a year. But it was very thoughtfully done. Now, when President Bush did the hydrogen economy idea, this was very popular at the time, but the level of science reaching up there, it was quite small. The president's science advisor no longer is close to the White House. He's down the block on Pennsylvania Avenue. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really thought through. There are some numbers that my students all learned that I wish he had known. If you take hydrogen, has more energy per pound than gasoline.
Okay.
But hydrogen is very, very diffuse. You can't compress it very much. In its best form, in liquid form, it actually has less energy per gallon than gasoline by about a factor of four. There are other issues, too, with the hydrogen economy. Hydrogen is not a source of energy. You have to make hydrogen. And presently, we make hydrogen out of typically out of coal or out of natural gas. And in the process, carbon dioxide is released. So the advantage there, the advantage of a hydrogen automobile is that you don't release any pollution from the automobile. The hydrogen burns mm-hmm. to make water
directly.
Vapor.
Mm-hmm.
Directly, right. So the pollution is all made at the power plant.
But it's still made somewhere. And here was a president making this the kind of jewel in the crown of his energy answer in 2003. Here's the big announcement. Let's go, nation, off in this direction. And you're saying it was the wrong direction.
Well, he found out it was the wrong direction. And the year later, in 2004, I noticed that there was no mention of the hydrogen economy in that State of the Union speech. So this is a case where the president is trying to show leadership. The people do get to him on this issue. He found out it was not practical, and he changed the vision after that.
Of course, he was only putting up $1.2 billion there compared to the $135 billion for space, and that was one where you say the engineering was already known. Richard Mueller, if you were sitting down with Barack Obama, with John McCain right now, sort of nose to nose, knee to knee, and giving them the short course we hope to hear at this hour, the sort of basics and what you feel they ought to know. You're looking in here at climate change, energy, nukes, terrorism. I wish you'd walk us through and sort of what we need to know on the physics front on each of these. And let's start with terrorism, if you'd be good enough. It's taken so much national attention since 9/11. The president will have, I guess, a lot of options on how he thinks about it and proposes tackling it. You're a physics guy. What does physics tell us about what's most important when it comes to thinking about terrorism?
Well, let me first try to separate my opinion from those of others. On terrorism, I'm going to say a few things that are my personal opinion and not just physics. Let me give you some of the physics, though. And mm-hmm. this is the key behind the attack to the World Trade Center. It's TNT is a explosive. It releases a certain amount of energy. I like to measure the energy in food calories per gram or per pound. If we compare the energy released by gasoline, many people are surprised to learn gasoline releases more energy, 15 times the energy of TNT.
And gas or jet fuel is essentially what went to work on 9/11 in those planes.
Exactly. The planes carried about 60 tons of jet fuel. And if you multiply that by 15 to get a sense of it, it was about 900 tons of TNT equivalent. Two planes, 1.8 kilotons of TNT equivalent. That's why there was so much damage done. Gasoline is, in my mind, the most dangerous thing, the thing that is perhaps the greatest danger for a future terrorist attack.
And yet you can buy it at any corner station. It's the most widely available. What does a president do about that?
Well, now we're getting off the realm of physics, because I believe the only thing you can really do is good police work, a good network, trying to catch the terrorists early on. Now, before 9/11, we were extremely tolerant of some rather bizarre behavior on behalf of those terrorists or the people who would be terrorists. They are people that would not move in a unnoticed, I think today. And I think the lack of terrorism since 9/11, something I said in my class on 9/12, I came in, changed the lecture completely. I told my students, as we learned last week, gasoline has 15 times the energy of TNT. Mm-hmm. Let me describe to you how the building collapsed, what happened. Basically, I got it all right. I think it was fairly obvious to a physicist that the fire had weakened the steel. Once the steel was weakened, the upper floors collapsed on it like a sledgehammer, and then that collapsed the lower floors, and this was obvious in watching the film. Years later, of course, engineering committees verified this, but I don't believe that Osama bin Laden expected that whole building to collapse. I don't think anybody did.
But you are saying, I mean, there are threats on the nuclear front or the biological front, but with gasoline packing so much energy, so much power, and so widely available, keep your eye right there, potentially as the means of the next attack, if there is one.
Yes, that's exactly right. Nukes are much harder than I think many people recognize. The North Korean nuclear explosion released one-third as much energy as the World Trade Center attack.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about physics and the Oval Office, what every American president needs to know. My guest is Richard Muller. He's professor of physics at the University of California, Berkeley. Teaches one of the most popular courses at the school, sometimes 1,000 students in it. It's called not Physics for Dummies or Physics for Jocks, but Physics for Future Presidents. It's the name of his new book as well. Richard Muller, I wish you'd listen with us for just a second to someone who's not likely to be in the office, the Oval Office, next year, but has been near it and was last week laying out some big new goals again. This is Vice President Al Gore, a Nobel Prize winner, last week challenging the nation to produce within 10 years every kilowatt of its electricity through Earth-friendly energy sources. Here he is setting that ambitious goal out.
So today I challenge our nation to commit to producing 100% of our electricity from renewable energy and truly clean carbon-free sources within 10 years.
100% from renewable energy and truly clean carbon-free sources within 10 years. Richard Muller, whoever takes the Oval Office next January, that Al Gore challenge is going to be sitting there in front of them. What do you make of it? Does that meet the possible test, the physics awareness test?
Well, what I like about Al Gore's statement is that he is pushing very, very hard for the U.S. for the government in particular, to have a program to work on those issues, the biggest of which is energy conservation, energy efficiency. The other things, of course, are solar power and wind. And I would love to see nuclear power included in that list. And I think pushing on the next government to do that is a good thing. The statement, I believe, is more political than technical. I've listened to the statement. I've talked to many real experts in different areas of the energy market, and nobody thinks we could do that. There are some very fundamental limits to how rapidly we can change over our economy.
Nobody thinks you could meet Al Gore's challenge, so it doesn't meet the kind of JFK visionary plus practical test.
No, but I don't think it was meant that way. I think it was meant as a push. You put up there's another issue, too, which is even if we were to do this, it would have almost no effect on global warming.
Because China and India and others out there are pumping out everything they're pumping out. But first of all, we'll come to that. But first of all, why do you say, as a professor of physics, I guess, why do you say you don't think it could be done?
Well, first, it's not really an Apollo-style program. It would be more like dropping all of our effort in almost everything to concentrate on energy in terms of the effort that would be needed. I think it's more like World War II, if we were to attempt to do that, than it is like Apollo. Apollo was, as I mentioned, only $10 billion per year. This would be much, much larger.
Why?
We get 40% of our energy from coal, mm-hmm. electrical power from coal right now, and that's the dirtiest thing. All of those hundreds of coal plants would have to be made clean or replaced by solar or wind. Solar and wind have a problem. They're intermittent. Except for certain kinds of solar plants, namely solar thermal plants, it's very hard to store the energy. So for a peak power crisis, it's not very good. We don't have the technology for storing that energy. It could be developed, but that's a development program. The U.S. government is working on those storage problems now. They're spending a large budget on that, but we don't have that yet. Solar power is coming along very rapidly, but there are some fundamental limits. I think, for example, if you look at the kind of solar cells that people are excited about, the issue of whether we could produce them in the numbers may be limited by some technical issues. One that comes to my mind is the element indium, which is used in all of these technologies, which I think will be in very short supply. So to think ahead, you also have to think about where are we going to get the indium for these large solar cells.
You've got my curiosity. What's indium? What's the role it plays in solar?
Well, indium is a metal that's transparent in thin layers to visible light. And so if you have an LCD screen home, it uses a layer of indium to bring the electricity to the individual cells. So mm-hmm. so it, right now, flat panel televisions are using up most of the world's indium.
Where's it come from?
I believe the mines are not in the United States. Mm-hmm. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure where it is.
Out there and not endless, and that, for one, required for solar. So what would you say to the next president about physics and the energy challenge? What's your advice? You're saying not hydrogen, not Al Gore's plan. What's the Richard Mueller professor of physics plan?
Well, the big winner is energy conservation. And this has a public perception problem because people think energy conservation means turning down your thermostat and putting on a sweater. A discomfort is associated with it.
Right.
Whereas, in fact, energy conservation really means putting a little more insulation in your walls, turning up the thermostat to whatever you want, and a 3-year payback. That's like over a 30% return on your investment. The United States, the government has not had a very strong program, an appropriately strong program in energy conservation, simply because they thought this should be left to the private sector. There are other kinds of clean energy. I would love to see a much invigorated program in nuclear power. Nuclear power was shoved aside years ago because of a public fear of radioactivity. And instead of confronting that fear and educating the public so that they know that this is not as bad as they think, the decision was simply made better to ignore it. After all, we have these clean fossil fuels that are so cheap. Back then, the public didn't realize that there was a downside to fossil fuels. So we have to relook at nuclear.
So conservation and nuclear power, I think the political advisors are going to be rushing into the room soon. We'll see how those would sell. We've got a lot of listeners who'd like to speak with you, Professor. Let me begin to turn to them. We're talking with Richard Mueller, Professor of Physics at Berkeley. His new book is Physics for Future Presidents. We've got a call from Glendale, California. And Mark, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question. I've been reading a lot about the whole global warming issue, and I was on board 100% behind it all. And then all of a sudden I started reading the junk science articles and all the rest of it. And one of the things that's really is frustrating to me is it seems like at any time you even have a question, or if you question the validity of a lot of these types of things and a lot of these programs that are supposedly trying to count on the carbon footprint, it's like you're speaking heresy, and it seems like it's a new religion for a lot of these wackos, when in reality it seems like a water vapor and a lot of other things are more to blame for global warming than even our carbon footprint.
So you've become skeptical about climate change warnings, Mark?
Become very skeptical of it. It seems like they're just trying to fearmonger. I mean, since 1970, the temperature, actually over the past 10 years, the temperature has come down. you know, if you look at the actual chart, it's frightening. And not only it's frightening that we're so afraid of it, and not only that, if you speak ill of it, it's heresy. And to me, any time that you can't talk, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe global warming is real. Maybe it is man-made. But if you can't question it, then you can never find out truth.
Mark, we've got our physics professor in the house, and he's ready to advise presidents. We hope he can advise us. Richard Mueller, how about it? Mark's prepared to see the warnings as new religion for a lot of wackos. Surely some of your fellow scientists wouldn't appreciate that. But what do you say?
Mark, you're right on. This is a very difficult problem because of that kind of polarization. And what's happening is that there is, as a scientist, I have struggled to separate out the extremists who exaggerate or cherry pick. What they'll do is they'll say, oh, we had wildfires in California last month, and we're having a drought in California, signs of global warming. They ignore the fact that right now in the studio I'm quite cold because now it's cold in California. I call that cherry picking. What's happened here is that scientists who have studied this problem are truly concerned that the problem is real. It, as you say, the temperature, you're absolutely right. The temperature has gone down in the last 10 years. I warned about this 5 years ago. I said another 5 or 10 years of cooling, which could just be a fluctuation because there are natural fluctuations on top of warming, will cause people to ignore the problem.
But it sounds like you're writing off global climate change. Do your students at Berkeley start throwing their Birkenstocks at you when you say that at the podium?
No, because I stick to the physics. And I find that's what I do in my book.
Yeah.
The whole idea here is let's cool it. Let's talk about the physics. I don't care what your opinion is or what – my students can't tell what my politics are. And I'm really proud of that. The physics are simply the let me we didn't
you
get
say there are abundant exaggerations on both sides. So
exactly.
Let's hear them. And where do you come down?
Well, let's take the global warming so far. I think as a guide, we should listen to Nobel laureate IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. If you want to understand global warming, you should know those letters. They share the Nobel Prize along with Al Gore.
With Al Gore, yeah.
Yeah, and they, what they say is quite different, for example, from what Al Gore says. Al Gore does a lot of cherry picking because his goal is to frighten you about global warming. If you look at what the IPCC says, they say climate change up until around 1957 may have been completely natural. Since 1957, humans have probably contributed, or they say very likely contributed to some of the 1 degree Fahrenheit warming that's taken place since then. So let's say half a degree Fahrenheit. This is enough to really concern, of which, by the way, a tenth or a 20th of a degree Fahrenheit was contributed by the United States.
Mm.
So now this is enough to really concern scientists because it does look like humans are affecting it. We're playing with dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think that you personally can sense a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit by looking at the weather, you're just not being scientific.
I think that's not what most people are really concerned about. They're concerned whether in another 50 or 100 years we may have climate change that just, brings so much destruction and displacement with it that people will look back and say, what weren't we doing?
That's exactly what I'm worried about. I'd summarize as follows. Climate change is real. The odds are very likely, this is what the IPCC says, 90%, they say, 90% chance that humans have contributed to it. If we are now contributing to climate change, it's still early enough to take this seriously and do something about it. When Al Gore says that the evidence is incontrovertible and overwhelming, he's actually disagreeing with the IPCC, who say there's a 10% chance that humans have not contributed because of the water vapor issue that Mark mentioned.
And what do you mean by the water vapor issue?
Well, when you increase carbon dioxide, it warms the Earth a little bit. That little bit of warming causes water vapor to be made from evaporate from the oceans,
mm-hmm.
and that doubles the effect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, water vapor is the big greenhouse gas, but when we make water vapor, when humans make water vapor, the amount we add is so minuscule it doesn't have an effect. When we add carbon dioxide, it is a big effect. So water vapor plays a role in the greenhouse effect, but it's not something – we don't have to worry about making water vapor from the hydrogen economy, for example. the carbon dioxide, water vapor does play a role. It is a big greenhouse effect. But what we're talking about here are incremental changes, the additional warming that we will get. And it's virtually imperceptible today. Increase in hurricanes? No, that's not global warming. In fact, the hurricanes hitting the United States have been going down. Increased wildfires? No, that's not global warming. In fact, in the United States, the number of wildfires has been going down. If you cherry pick and pick the statistics that sound bad, and you only mention those and attribute it to global warming, you're not doing science.
And
you're doing politics.
What about the picking from the other side that the president would have to be aware of as well? I mean, those who say, you know, cut it out, stop this, all this talk about global climate change is ridiculous. Let's keep on keeping on. What about that cherry picking?
That's the danger with exaggerating the global warming. I mean, Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth is so full of cherry picking and exaggeration, whether it's the polar bears dying or the glacier of Antarctica flooding New York City and all those things. There's such exaggeration that people who are not familiar with the core science in the middle will attack Al Gore. And that's the danger of exaggerating. He is very easy to attack because he's trying to make a political point. He cherry picks and picks those issues which are dramatic and are frightening. But in doing that, he leaves himself vulnerable. So people on the other side think that if they attack him, they're throwing out the science.
So what? How do you end up advising a president then? I mean, perhaps there are failings there, but Al Gore's been in politics. Perhaps he knows what it takes to motivate a country to do about something about a big threat. A, do you see a significant threat here? And what would your advice to a president be then on climate change?
Well, I do see a serious threat. I am concerned about global warming. And I know my own limitations. The big problem, as you mentioned earlier, is not in the United States. If we continue at the rate that we're doing or even grow a little bit, the United States will contribute maybe another couple tenths of a degree to global warming. The global warming that's coming is from China and India, and we have to do something about that. This involves a lot of things a physicist from the Bronx doesn't really know about. Somehow, we have to get China and India to produce less in the way of greenhouse gases, maybe encourage them to go nuclear. There are ways of doing clean coal where you actually burn coal, but you sequester the carbon dioxide. We need that. I don't know that they're willing to pay for it, though, since they are so far behind us economically.
It sounds as though you might see George W. Bush's policies on global climate and climate change is just about right then. He's been very resistant to moving unless India and China did. He seems to have said, let's be careful about how much we invest in this because the payoff is unclear, the threat is unclear. Are you satisfied with President Bush's climate policy?
No. I mean, we need to address this. Just from the research aspect, which is what I know best, there isn't nearly enough work done in conservation and energy efficiency, and that has to be an important part of the Chinese program too. They are far more wasteful than we are in terms of the carbon dioxide they produce per GNP. So there's a real possibility there. The idea that we will set an example doesn't work either. I don't think so. If I were the premier of China and I was asked to cut back on your economic growth in order to prevent the temperature from going up a few years, I don't know that I would do that. I suspect, and this is not physics, but I suspect that the developed countries will have to subsidize the developing countries in order to get them to keep the temperature cool for us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about physics and the Oval Office, what every American president needs to know. My guest is Richard Muller, professor of physics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's author of Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. The title of the book comes from the title of his class, one of the most popular at Berkeley, where he introduces students to the physics that lie behind some of the major issues in front of all of us and certainly in front of presidents and presidential candidates these days. Right now we've got a call from Hartford, Connecticut. And Bruce, you're on the air with the good professor.
Yes, thank you. Professor Muller, I've been a science fiction fan all my life.
in the 1960s, I seem to recall Arthur Clarke proposing putting large solar arrays in orbit and beaming the power to Earth via microwave. That would be free and sustainable. What are your thoughts upon that?
Well, I'm a real fan of Arthur Clarke, and he, of course, suggested things such as geosynchronous satellites. On the solar array thing, most of that light reaches the surface of the Earth. And right now it costs $1,000 a pound to put something in space. The advantage of doing that is it could be out in the sunlight all of the time. You could point it, and whereas if it's on the surface of the Earth, it's only one-third efficient just because the sun sets and it doesn't always come at the optimum angle. On the other hand, the disadvantages of the price. Remember, if we don't solve this problem for China and India, we're not really addressing the issue. And it's not really competitive even with current day solar on the ground. The problem with solar on the ground is it's a factor of three or four times more expensive than coal and other fossil fuels. So it's a price issue, and we can't afford that. Microwaving it down to the ground also bothers me a bit. What you're doing is converting visible light, which comes through the atmosphere very well, to microwaves. You're trying to concentrate it. So you're basically taking that energy and sending it down into a very narrow channel. And my guess is the environmentalists would really vigorously oppose that for a harm that it could conceivably do.
Your bigger advice on space and NASA to the president, as you have it here in your presidential summary on space, is, as I read you, ditch the astronauts, make it all robots, cut the cost, but keep going.
Well, in fact, most scientists recognize the fact that to get into space, they have to have astronauts along because that's the only way they will get approved. In fact, they would much rather do it without astronauts. The program of man in space is generally justified by the need to do the science. Most scientists would much rather send it up with unmanned. Men move, they breathe, they emit pollutants, they really make it harder. Yes, they can fix things now and then, but the added expense of making your satellite safe for humans is so high that it would be better just to send up a duplicate satellite if one fails. You would save money.
Andrew's calling, also from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question for the professor. He mentioned that we really need to subsidize as a China and India. And I would think that if we pushed in terms of conservation and working on programs that would make things more affordable with conservation, energy efficiency, and whatnot, then that would be available to China and India and therefore would make them cleaner without having to subsidize them, because it would be the cheapest thing to do. I think what they're doing now is what's cheapest.
Professor Mueller, so put our minds to work. We don't have to send a subsidy, but come up with the solutions. Come up with the breakthroughs.
Well, this is why a vigorous research program is really important. The problem right now is that coal is literally dirt cheap. And that's what you're competing with. There's a great incentive, even in the United States, to try to, even if it weren't for the environmental aspects of it, to bring solar and wind power down. Wind is having a great expansion in the United States right now. In fact, we're building windmills so fast that the number that we build is limited by how fast the factories can put them out. So there are these alternatives. China and India are deeply interested in these, but they have so much coal. And it is so cheap. They have enormous coal reserves. The India also has large coal reserves. So they know how to build them using their own technology. Ironically, the memory that China has for you from imperialism from Europe and the United States is so bad that they really don't want to take U.S. technology. They want to develop it themselves. So that creates some problems that a mere physics professor has trouble even thinking about. Mm-hmm. There is an initiative in California now. It was passed. It's called AB 32. California is going to satisfy the Kyoto Accords. This, in a sense, is giving a kickstart to industry in California to develop the technology because there's a ready market right here. Eventually, the hope is that this technology will be shared and used in China and India. But this is a long-term solution. I would love to see the government get more involved in developing these energy-efficient energy. We waste an enormous amount of energy. I give my students a physics example. In the first lecture of most mechanics courses taken by physics majors, they learn that to move something horizontally does no work, takes no work.
Mm.
That's very counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
All of it goes to friction. In fact, all of the energy when we transport ourselves in automobiles is wasted as friction. In principle, cars could be far more efficient than they are today. So there are lots of things that can be done.
As someone who studies physics, you call that the good news. There's so much waste, that's an opportunity. It's not just turning down the thermostat, but find technology answers to cutting back on that waste as well.
Yeah, and it's not just me. There's been a major study by one of the best one of the best business analyst companies, McKinsey Corporation, in which they are now deeply getting into this. They see this, I guess, as a market, as an opportunity for business. And they've produced a report that shows very clearly that when you look at these things in great detail, the best investment you could make right now is in energy conservation and energy efficiency. So those are what people call the low-hanging fruit. But Amory Lovins calls it the fruit that's on the ground. You just have to pick it up.
Let's get a call from Steve in Guilford, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for putting me on. My question involves the disposal of the waste from nuclear power plants, especially with Yucca Mountain, which is becoming a huge deal, especially locally in Nevada. Now, if you look at what we're actually planning on putting into the repository, it's about 97% uranium in the spent fuel, which is just unburned. And that's actually less toxic than lead. On the other hand, we're moving, you know, enormous volumes of stuff basically to get rid of a small amount of stuff like cesium-135 and technetium-99. Should we start looking at reprocessing again to, you know, try to recycle some of this stuff and really concentrate on the real nasty stuff to get rid of?
Greg, it's a big issue with Richard Mueller, and a great question, Richard Mueller.
The waste issue, I think, is one that is a key issue right now. It's the main impediment to nuclear power. I argue in my book that the problem has been greatly exaggerated. And there are pressures on both sides. The anti-nuclear people exaggerate it because they want to stop things. And I think even the people working the field, working this thing, love to solve problems. If we look at the radioactivity of the nuclear waste, I like to compare it not to some absolute level, but to the radioactivity that was taken out of the ground when the uranium was originally mined. Now, some of the radioactivity lasts for more than 24,000 years. Mm-hmm. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years. Mm. But in fact, those elements that you mentioned, the cesium-135, the technetium-99, these things have relatively short half-lives. And after 150 years, the bulk of the radioactivity has already disappeared. The main reason we are not recycling right now is because it costs, taking out the uranium, taking out the plutonium and reprocessing it. The main reason we're not doing that is because it's more expensive than just mining new uranium. So it's really a financial issue. I argue in the book that if we take the measure being the natural radioactivity in the ground, that if we were to store it for 100 years, 150 years, and after 150 years, there's only a 10% chance that 10% will leak, that we're back where we started. It's no more dangerous than the uranium that was originally moved from the ground. I think waste storage is a technically solved problem, and the difficulty is the public perception of this.
So that means you, I guess, would advise a president to push hard for more nuclear power?
I would advise the president to appear before the public, to explain the issue, to say we put nuclear power aside because fossil fuel was so cheap and we thought it was clean. Now that we recognize there are dangers to fossil fuels, in fact, the dangers of nuclear look quite small in comparison with that. We should push very hard on nuclear power.
Let's get a call from Beverly, Massachusetts, and Greg. Greg, you're on the air.
Could you please give me an update on fusion power? It was supposed to be the alternative to fission. Talked about some 30 years ago, and it seems like everyone has forgotten about fusion and all of the hope that it was supposed to bring. Thank you.
Yeah, fusion has not been forgotten. There are still major developments going on in the primary kind of fusion reactor called a tokamak. There's a big program called ITER, I-T-E-R, which is a huge fusion device. The problem is that many problems have been solved. The story, as you may remember, is that it's always 20 years in the future.
Mm.
Well, 20 years in the future from now, we will likely have a working design that could actually produce power. 20 years after that, we may have many of these things. 40 years is too long to wait right now.
But is it, do you see it in this century as a, I don't know, kind of a savior on the energy front, or always 20 years out there?
Well, given the fact that I think fission, solar is coming along very quickly, wind is coming along real quickly, the challenge to that is going to be cheaper than these alternatives. And I suspect it will not be.
Let's go to Idaho, American Falls, Idaho. And John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question for the professor is, I'd like to have him address coal gasification. We're about to build a coal gasification plant near American Falls, and it has been publicized to be a clean way of receiving energy from coal. And I'd like to have him talk about that a little bit, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, John. Richard Muller?
Yes, I'm a real fan of coal gasification. This is what I refer to when I talk about clean coal.
Can you explain how it works, what it is?
What you do is you take coal, get it very hot, mix it with water, and you produce carbon monoxide and hydrogen. The carbon monoxide can then be put. Let's say you're using it for energy. There are other things you could use it for. You could make plastics out of it, for example. The carbon monoxide then becomes the feedstock. You run it through a turbine. The favorite kind is actually first a high temperature turbine, then a low temperature turbine. You do this. You burn it in pure oxygen, which you can get by taking off a little bit of the energy to separate oxygen from the atmosphere. You wind up getting an extremely efficient plant. But what's really important is that carbon dioxide is produced at the power plant. That is basically pure carbon dioxide, if you burned it in pure oxygen, in the form that you can really use to pump it underground into salt brines, a process called carbon storage and sequestration, or just CSS or sequestration. And this is a technology which I think I would compare that technology to the Apollo program, sequestration. People say, we haven't done it yet. But the engineering, I regard as straightforward, almost certainly going to work. Early tests will show us whether it's going to work or not.
And it would keep that CO2 out of the atmosphere, out of the climate change picture.
That's right, and out of coal. So when people referred to clean coal in the past, they meant low sulfur, low mercury. Now clean coal means low carbon dioxide. And I think this is a technology that has been pushed by the Department of Energy. They have been developing it. A program was recently canceled. We could talk about that at length. But I think the coal gasification has a great future.
Let's go to Berlin, Vermont, and Brett. Brett, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just was calling about, they were talking about the energy storage and the problems with that. And I'm wondering, at times of low sun or wind power, can they build reservoirs that are large enough to hold water and then use that, potentially for energy when you have those low sun and wind times?
Well, somehow store energy in a reservoir? Richard Muller, what do you say?
It's the best way to store energy. In fact, during the California energy crisis, California had a deal with Washington State that we would supply their power during all times if they would pay it back with their water storage from their dams, that could be done.
But what, doesn't that mean heat in the water? Where do you want to put all that heat in water?
No, you just pump the water up. Actually, in this case, you don't even pump it up. They would just stop using their dams for electricity. We would supply that. And then when we needed electricity, they would use their dams. So it was basically it's a convenient way to store energy. The problem with it is lack of water. And we have dams over the U.S. There are some we'd like to get rid of, like Hetch Hetchy in California. The alternative is probably the best alternative today is pressurizing air and storing it in cavities underground. Other possibilities, hydrogen fuel cells, those look like they're less efficient. Batteries can be used in certain cases. If you have solar thermal, what you're doing is taking solar energy, concentrating it, and heating up a liquid and storing it in heat. That, it turns out, you can store that energy for quite a long time. It's just in the form of heat. But water, the real problem is lack of water.
You've got two candidates out there right now. Do you see one as more or less attuned to physics than the other in Barack Obama and John McCain?
I really try to be apolitical here, and I think either one of them, I think, could get in front of the public and make the case that for sticking to the nonpartisan, physics is nonpartisan. And I think if we make the case in physics, then everybody can get on board.
Richard Muller's new book is Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. We'll see. Maybe we'd like to see them in the front row of your class, Professor. Thanks very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.